Well, how nice to see you all, and what a pleasure to be here. And thank you very much, Hubert, for your very generous introduction, but also your kind hosting of me today. And I was very pleased to be invited, and I hope that we'll have a good evening. Today I want to speak about diversity, which is a long-running trope in the higher education literature. Higher education systems are continually evolving, and the system is shaped by three broad tendencies, I would argue, in this period, that combine in various ways in different countries. The first tendency is partial global integration or convergence between national systems, or globalisation. It takes the form of global systems such as the research system alongside cross-border borrowing and other forms of interaction between nations and institutions. The second is the intensification of competition in many but not all countries and the adoption of business-like features, marketisation. The third tendency is mass-scale growth, massification as it's often called. Now, more is written about globalisation and marketisation than massification, yet massification is monumental in scale and it's the most universal of the three tendencies. Global convergence touches some national systems more than others. Marketisation has reshaped higher education in the English-speaking world, but in many other systems tuition remains free or low cost. Business models play a more modest role. However, almost every higher education system everywhere, in countries in which national income is more than about 5,000 US per capita, and some with less than 5,000, have experienced massive growth in participation. In fact, in one third of all higher education systems across the world, more than 50% of the school leaver age group is now enrolled in some form of tertiary education, meaning two-year diploma programs or above. In countries that reach the 50% mark, they just seem to go on expanding towards 100%, and Korea is very close to that level now. In a cross-country project I've been sharing for the last 3 years with colleagues from the United States, Canada, Ireland, Norway, Finland, Poland, Russia and Japan, we call these 50% plus systems high participation systems. We're in the later stages of preparation of a book on high participation systems, and I want to draw on that work today to discuss the dynamics of diversity within national systems. And that's one of the, as you can see, one of the four generic chapters, chapters 3 to 6. In the book. In an early and influential treatment, Birnbaum distinguishes between diversity, meaning variety in terms of specific characteristics of HEIs, and differentiation or diversification, movement towards diversity. He used several variables to record differences between HEIs and to establish categories. Size, legal foundation, sector of control, with state or private sector, disciplinary program, degree level, services offered, procedural differences in teaching and research, climate and values, and differences in the student body, including age, sex and ethnic origin. Other scholars have added reputational diversity, perceived differences in status and prestige, and also institutional mission. An important distinction is that between vertical and horizontal diversity, and for Ulrich Teichler, vertical diversity distinguishes HEIs by quality, reputation, prospective status of graduates. Teichler's horizontal diversity refers to disciplines and styles of teaching. Horizontal diversity can also include differences in mission and governance or internal organisational culture. And today I'll use the term diversity to refer to horizontal differences between institutions and reserve the word stratification for the vertical dimension of variety between institutions. Let me say something briefly about stratification, which is not going to be my main topic here. I mean, the weightiest distinction between HEIs derives from comparisons of research intensity. Research activity affects mission, and it's so important in contemporary higher education, and aspects of it are so readily measured and calibrated, for example, in research evaluation, ranking, and competitive funding rounds, that research-related distinctions always seem to have positional implications, always seem to have vertical implications. Now, in the High Participation Systems Project, we found that as participation expands, there is a secular tendency to steeper stratification, though this can be countered by government regulation and funding. As systems expand, places in elite research intensive HEIs shrink as a proportion of total places. Competition for entry into the elite segment intensifies, and with the whole middle class fighting for places, and fine differences between institutions in student selectivity, research intensity and or price are magnified. However, as I said, stratification is not my main focus today, interesting and all as it is, and I want to look primarily at horizontal differences in institutional mission, which I'm calling systemic diversity. I'll look at mission, classification, type and form of activity profile, including structural diversity in legal foundation, public or private, and there's also the question of how identified difference is understood. Burnham's measure of diversity is simply the number of institutional types divided by the total number of HEIs. Now, Wang and Jia, in an interesting paper 2 years ago, identified three structural notions of diversity. Systems are more diverse if they include a greater number of institutional types, which I think is where Burnham was going. They're more diverse if the distribution of HEIs between the main institutional types is more equally weighted. They're not overly dominated just by one type. And they're more diverse if there's a greater distance in kind between the institutional types. Now today I'm speaking largely in generic terms about diversity, but the generalisations are underpinned by the empirical observations from the literature and the national case studies in our project. At any time, systemic diversity is impacted by a range of local factors, such as regional access and development, government policies, funding mechanisms, research competition, and international factors such as cross-border competition and ranking. In many countries, diversity has also been affected by neoliberal policy and regulation. National systems clearly vary in the extent of horizontal diversity, vertical stratification or both. In the UK, higher education is a competitive system with modest horizontal diversity and steep but informal stratification. It's differentiated by research and student selectivity. Nordic and German-speaking systems use primarily horizontal diversity and binary systems to differentiate, though this is beginning to shift. Some countries primarily house research inside universities, some primarily or partly make extensive use of specialist academies and laboratories, including Germany, France, Russia and China. And the role of specialist HEIs varies greatly from country to country. The two largest systems in China and the United States use institutional classifications to order an explicit hierarchy that's also functional by mission. Great diversity, in other words, between systems, but I think we can identify common secular tendencies across these systems. Today I'll reflect on the prior scholarship on diversity, and then I'll move to actual existing diversity in high participation systems. The research and scholarship. Research and scholarship is a disappointing when you look at the last 20, 30 years of what's been done on diversity, because it tends to have become hypnotised by two types of study, neither of which have really got us there. Two major questions. As often in social science research, the objective seems to be to achieve a general causal relation between two complex mega variables with both directions of causality in play, to try to establish, in other words, a kind of universal social law. I'm not sure whether this sector lends itself easily to universal social laws, at least something as well formed, as precise as that. First, there's the search for a general causal relation between growth and diversity. For example, by mapping diversity in an individual national system over time, seeing what happens to it as the system grows, or by combining statistically based analysis of various national systems, different points in a spectrum of growth in diversity. The second type of study attempts to find whether or to demonstrate that market competition in higher education is associated with greater horizontal diversity between institutions, or alternately with less horizontal diversity. Some such studies also study the three-way relationship between growth, competition, and diversity. Note that in the second set of questions, the independent variable is the market, not the state. Though across the world, the state is more ubiquitous in higher education than the market, and usually the state controls the educational markets anyway. This reflects the leading role of American scholars in the discussion, in which the state is downplayed habitually, and in many countries it also reflects the preoccupation with the pros and cons of marketisation agendas. Research on the relation between growth and diversity has been unsatisfying because I think too many national contextual factors are at play that affect patterns of diversity, including historically inherited forms that vary by country, political cultures that vary by country, different state policy and regulation. It's been exceedingly difficult to try to derive a robust generic quantitative relation between expansion and diversity of provision given those contextual factors. For example, some HPS are more engaged in neoliberal marketisation than others, and that affects these sorts of comparisons. I mean, how do you wait for the effect of neoliberal marketisation as a whole? The outcome of such studies are inconclusive, or they tend to be largely shaped by the selection of cases, like the major study by Shavit and company published in 2007, a very interesting volume, I think a very good set of studies, but quite unsatisfactory in terms of its overall conclusions and findings. Now, partly because of this lacuna, I think, in the relationship between growth and diversity, much of the discussion of diversity has become hijacked by the second debate, which is the debate about the market diversity hypothesis, as I call it. Now, this hypothesis functions as a sort of taken for granted norm in Anglo-American policy. I mean, it's taken for granted that if you put higher education into a market, that's going to lead to greater horizontal diversity, a better range of offerings, whether it's driven by the consumer or it's driven by the producer looking for market opportunities, or both. However, this position in policy also has plenty of critics. The problem here is that the discussion has not really been about diversity. The market diversity debate is a proxy for the marketisation debate. The discussion's basically been about the pros and cons of marketisation. The market diversity hypothesis functions variously, as an unquestionable assumption and as a sort of site for investigation. The hypothesis is that all else being equal, market competition in higher education tends to both facilitate and enhance diversity of institutional mission and type. Advocates of the hypothesis also claim that all else being equal, the growth of participation leads to greater diversity, provided that governments step back and allow market competition free play, as if HEIs emerge, evolve and specialise in response to diverse consumer needs in the manner of retail services. Other and related contentions are that under conditions of market competition, growth is facilitated and this further fosters diversity, and greater diversity fosters further growth, and so on. Institutional diversity is said to increase the range of choices available to students, better match their needs to educational programs by the supply-demand conjunction, and respond to diverse labour markets. You're familiar with all these assumptions, but they are just that, they're just assumptions. Now, in studies animated by the market diversity hypothesis, there appears to be a kind of meta-assumption at the base of thought, sort of trinity of related virtues: market competition, diversity and growth. Market competition is the starting point, providing favourable conditions for the other virtues to emerge and to foster each other. Research in this tradition sets out to reproduce the meta-assumption in its findings. It looks for illustrations of the synchrony of market competition, diversity and growth. And when the virtuous relationship fails to appear, as nearly every time it does, this is blamed on undue intervention by the state, which is external to the trinity. The remedy is to clear the state away, of course, deregulation. Then it will all happen as the virtuous picture assumes. Within this rhetorical frame, the original assumption that the market diversity hypothesis is protected from refutation on the basis of actual existing cases, because all failures can be blamed on the state. Of course, the critics of the marketisation argument do not share these assumptions. So what you have is two groups in the literature that are talking past each other rather than with each other. The market diversity hypothesis emerged in the United States in the work of Birnbaum and others. And in his great essay on the transition from elite to mass higher education, Martin Trow in 1973 showed that he was really soaked in this hypothesis himself when he argued that growing diversity was natural to growing systems, though it under conditions where they were free to compete, although it could become stifled by government regulation. Now, almost as a footnote though, he noted, as had been previously identified by David Riesman in an important book in 1958, and a point that anticipates the institutionalist narrative about isomorphistic patterns, Trow noted the tendency for institutions to converge towards the forms and practices of the most prestigious models of higher education, a tendency that operates independently of government control. Here, Trow then stated, academically controlled higher education was hostile to the subversive richness of markets. So that left the market assumption intact. Remarkably, in his insightful essay, Trow failed to consider the point that markets can also generate homogeneity of ambition and type. Now, in the United States, historical variation between the states and in private sector HEIs has produced a complex mix of research and doctoral universities, elite liberal arts colleges, lesser public universities, public community colleges, for-profit corporate colleges, vocational education, and a lot of on-the-job training. Same tier HEIs compete with each other and are routinely ranked, but they're also segmented into different tiers. This variety of types, which in the United States has become associated also with the idea of a system market in higher education, is seen, at least at home, as central to the virtues of American higher education. Institutional diversity is frequently positioned as an innate good based on a set of related assumptions about student choice, functional specialisation, and the engagement of diverse higher education institutions with diverse sectors of society. Now, the United States was also the first high participation higher education system. Perhaps this first mover advantage, coupled with American geopolitical preponderance, turned the narrative joining market, diversity and growth into a global education policy norm. However, the actual existing American institutional diversity, developed long before not just 50% participation but 10% participation, and also long predates the ideology of a system market in higher education. Historically, diversity was not the outcome of either massification or market competition in the United States. Now, that still leaves room for the alternative virtuous narrative, in which decentralized competition and diversity are the condition of the subsequent growth. However, growth to near universal levels has occurred in several systems that do not exhibit American-style decentralized diversity, including Finland and South Korea, that have much closer government control over mission type and less variety overall. Further, while an American-style multi-origin, multi-form, semi-decentralized system has evolved in other countries, such as Brazil and India, these did not exhibit tendencies to accelerated growth until very recently. And this suggests that contextual factors other than diversity or market ideology, such as national wealth, a burgeoning middle class, geopolitical preponderance, the enrichment on the through the exploitation of the rest of the world, economic modernisation, and the need for meritocratic forms of social legitimation in a democracy are needed to explain the emergence of high participation education in the United States. Certainly, the next generation of American researchers, after Trow and Birnbaum, looking at patterns of diversity between the states and over time, reached different conclusions generally, often questioned the market diversity hypothesis, sometimes to their surprise. Morphew in 2000 identified the tendency of diverse groups of institutions to grow more homogenous over time, as similar degree programs are adopted by institutions with seemingly different missions and resources, and a concurrent tendency towards mission homogeneity within systems. Eccle in 2008 identified two tendencies, homogenisation of mission and enhanced stratification. And Johnson in 2010, in a very good study, noted that for the most part in the process of growth, US HEIs did not specialise on the basis of submarkets or niche markets. Instead, they tended to broaden or widen rather than narrow or focus their positions. There was a widespread tendency for institutions to accumulate size and functions, in which internal diversity increased but external diversity diminished. HEIs broadened their social reach through the upward drift of largely teaching HEIs to the research domain and the downward drift of research HEIs into mass teaching and applied research, sometimes by creating new branch campuses that were more teaching orientated and less research intensive than the parent campus, and elbowing out potential non-university institutions in the process. And in some states there was also an upward drift from the sub-degree level in community colleges to degree programs. Outside the US after 1990, there was also growing scepticism about the market diversity hypothesis, as it still continues to rule in policy, let me emphasise. In the UK and Australia, unitary competitive systems were established in place of regulated binary structures amid policy rhetoric about the fostering of diversity through the market competition. Both systems came to largely consist of HEIs with a single teaching research template ordered in a steep informal status hierarchy regulated by research intensity, resources and student selectivity. High stratification, low horizontal diversity. While the state enforced common missions and it continued to shape institutional behaviour, providing one explanation for homogeneity of mission, it was apparent also that market forces also fostered imitation and convergence. In a study of mimetic institutional convergence in Australia, at a time when the standardisation of missions in larger institutions was coinciding with rapid enrolment growth, Lynn Meek concluded that institutions in direct competition with each other are more likely to emulate each other's teaching and research programs than to diversify in order to capture a particular market niche. In Europe, most scholars reached similar conclusions that questioned the market diversity hypothesis. They also noted that sometimes the escape from tight government regulation through the corporatisation of university forms enabled more freedom of choice in relation to mission. But it was apparent from the succession of European studies that government was not a prima facie suppressor of diversity. Its potential was ambiguous. At times the state would homogenise missions and iron out local idiosyncrasies, and the burden of regulation had those effects. And we see that here today, I think, in the UK. But also the state was able to structure the variety into systems, I mean, as in the creation of binary sectors, for example. Whereas with market forces, the verdict was more clear-cut. They tended to foster conformity with standard norms. Frans van Vught noted that the sources of homogenisation were academic conformity and government regulation, but states could foster diversity on a planned basis, citing the case of Hong Kong. He argued that government expectations for marketisation reform, that it would lead to distinctive products and strategies, were bound to be disappointed. Why is it that when free to determine their own strategies, HEIs prefer to imitate each other rather than innovate in response to the consumer student? Well, his answer was that because higher education is an experience good, students can only judge its quality after they've been enrolled. So HEIs are driven not by consumers, but by competition with each other for institutional reputation and prestige, and for the best students, faculty, research contracts and endowments. Competition based on reputation is, of course, naturally conservative. It leads to the minimisation of innovations which carry substantial risk. These findings in both European and more recent American literatures are convincing. Though competition does not always foster mimetic behaviour, for example, the original competition-driven and highly successful global strategy of the Singapore universities, in markets overall, the tendency to convergence seemed too strong to ignore. However, the real question to me is, does this matter? Is market diversity really the main question about diversity? Does this line of argument or inquiry generate for us the most fruitful research into the actual character of systems? The dominance of the market diversity debate indicates not its profound relevance to the diversity issue, but the tenacious hold of marketisation narratives on both the policy imagination and the critical agendas. But the preoccupation with refuting or defending market diversity has long been unhelpful, blocking a more nuanced and empirically grounded consideration of diversity in high participation systems. Likewise, to pose the problematic as what is the one-to-one causal relation between growth and diversification is another cul-de-sac, because a definitive answer is impossible. A more relevant question is, what systemic and institutional configurations are typical of higher education in the HPS era and why? And what tendencies in terms of systemic and institutional configuration are at work? What forms, homogenised or diversified, are becoming more or less important? Now, with that answered, the secular tendencies in the relationship between growth and horizontal diversity can be investigated, identified and discussed. There's much variety at national level, as I've said, but the high participation systems works suggested to us that there are three main features of the organisational environment that bear on diversity of institutional mission and type. And these three are connected. First, the rise of the multiversity, the large comprehensive research university, to a more dominant role within systems, together with the growth in the size and scope of individual multiversities. Second, an overall reduction, with some national exceptions, in the role of semi-horizontal binary sector distinctions and single-purpose institutions. Is there overall decline in the horizontal sense? Well, I think probably yes, except for online forms and, in some countries, the growing role of for-profit sectors. And this, if there is an overall decline, it counters the assumption that larger, more higher participation systems with more diverse students and more diverse clientele and stakeholders at the receiving end would naturally become more diverse in form and content. Third, growing internal diversity within the comprehensive multi-purpose institutions. Now, these three features can be understood as secular tendencies in current higher education systems. And I suspect that these three secular tendencies will tend to show in any high participation system where they can freely emerge. Now, the large comprehensive research multiversity has become more dominant in two related ways. First, it has normative power, increasingly as the sole ideal model of HEI. Second, its material weight within national systems has grown. The latter has several manifestations. A larger proportion of national system activity, resources and status is concentrated in multidisciplinary, multi-purpose research universities, multiversities. Research-intensive multiversities are elevated further above other institutions. The world-class university movement in many systems signifies this trajectory. Further, below the research-focused universities, we find another layer of comprehensive multi-purpose institutions that now mostly carry the title university, even though they don't conduct much research. In their comprehensive character, these institutions mirror the research in multiversity and their tendency to grow. They even perhaps more spectacularly outdo the research-intensive multiversity. Their prestige is more fraught. The title university no longer carries the guarantees that it used to carry. Yet status decline is not the whole story here. By adopting multiversity forms, institutions that are in the lower middle of degree-granting HEIs can partly protect themselves from the downward pressures on the value of their education and their brand that occurs in massifying systems. Now, the multiversity tends to include or absorb other institutional forms, and it also exhibits a broader range of single institutional configurations and considerably greater internal complexity and diversity than did its predecessor research universities. As systems grow, the average size of the research multiversities tends to increase, often markedly, as does that of the less prestigious research-light multiversities. In many systems, the multiversity becomes more autonomous and self-driving in the corporate sense, though mostly while remaining tethered to state policy and regulation. In an early, prescient, and in fact brilliant summary, I think, of the emerging form in the United States, the uses of the university. Clark Kerr coined multiversity as a term to describe what the American research university was then becoming. Features of the multiversity were growth, aggregation of functions and activity, accumulation of social and economic status and resources, external extension and managed internal heterogeneity. The multiversity was powered by different normative principles, including inquiry and knowledge creation, transmission of ideas and values, pastoral care, community service, collegial fellowship and managerial efficiency. It was replete with competing internal interests and external stakeholders. It became ever more multi via additional disciplines, fields of training, research agendas and funding, functions, activities, constituencies, personnel. It engaged with business, the professions, the arts, government, cities and local communities. The expansion of higher education systems to include the bulk of society was being matched by the expansion in the size, reach and complexity and the connectedness of the central institution, happening in the United States in 1960s, maybe happening in the rest of the world in the next 50, 60 years. Kerr's corporatised unit multiversity became the global trend. The quasi-corporate form of executive-led, strategy-driven and performance-managed institution is spreading everywhere. Governments support the downward transfer of responsibility and regulated autonomy within the constraints of funding, accountability and audit, and have discovered the form is compatible with much variation in policy, intents, specifics, cultural contents and the extent of and means of control. Clark, in 1998, defined it as the entrepreneurial university. Marginson and Considine in 2000 called it the enterprise university. The term world-class university is less helpful in analysis as it refers to relative quality, you know, whether you're included in the top 500 or 100, not absolute quality. However, there's no doubt that the multiversity norm was more firmly globally patterned by the Shanghai Academic Ranking of World Universities, which began in 2003, and the rather more dubious Times Higher Market Research Ranking, which began in 2004. Apologies to Oxford, which has just been made number one, but I've been on the board of the Times Higher for 5 years and I've never liked the ranking. The template used by both the ARWU and the Times Higher has deeply entrenched the large Anglo-American research university, comprehensive in science, publishing globally in English. And this template has underpinned the evolution of the 985 group in China, Excellence Initiative in Germany, Merger Program in France, Reforms Japan, Korea and about another 35 other countries. Moram, Maher and Baker in 2008 talked about the Global Research University or GRU. Perhaps the term Global Research Multiversity is about right. It highlights the internal heterogeneity as well as reach. It's independent of space, time and ideology. It distinguishes the present institution from the smaller and less global elite universities prior to community globalisation that began after 1990. Now, what's interesting is this, I think, that in the high participation systems, the elite university has changed its character in certain ways. The conventions governing size have altered. Now, at a given time, all HEIs want to expand their social weight and accumulation and aggregation are principal means for expanding your social weight. At the same time, in elite multiversities, the need to sustain students' selectivity and concentrate high-performance research activity, often in constrained physical spaces like this university has, is decisive, and that sets natural limits on expansion. Now, what's striking is that this equilibrium, at least in an average sense, is now fixed at a much larger scale than before. And managed growth is central to the strategies of many elite HEIs. Some, of course, have reached their size, like Oxford. And there are some that have also remained, a small number have remained very small. For example, in 2016, Caltech had 1,001 first degree students and 1,251 graduate students. But that's exceptional. And size is one of the principal tools of Harvard. I mean, Harvard has 80% more high citation papers than the next one on the list, which is Stanford. It's almost double Stanford's output and far ahead of everyone else, of course. And it, on the whole, it's grown over the years, physically and in terms of resources, in terms of space. As Van Vugt stated, the multiversity is driven fundamentally by the desire for social status and position. And we can add desires for social effect, especially as manifest in social centrality and leadership. Hence, the multiversity also wants to acquire public and private resources for the research, infrastructure, teaching programs and services that underpin social status and leadership. These twin objectives, status and resources, which produce each other in this frame, together explain the multiversity's accumulative logic and its quasi-market hunger. The more functions, students, land and buildings, the more research glory that it acquires, the stronger is the gravitational pull of its status. Every advance of status triggers possible further resources. In this manner, the multiversity is shaped between two contrary and compelling logics. The logic of selectivity, which generates status by increasing unit value, concentrating value, and the logic of aggregation of functions, reach and power, in which total value expands. It's striking, isn't it, that institutional status is generated through both quantity and quality in different ways. On one hand, through accumulation and extension. On the other hand, through concentration and intensification. These logics are heterogeneous, yet they each need the other in this frame. On one hand, high selectivity that is not coupled with social coverage leads to marginal influence. And I should in defense of Caltech, so I should say that there's more than one way to achieve extensive social reach. And while Caltech only has 2,255 students, its research budget is huge. It's the size of the University of Toronto, which is a premier research university, and has 86,709 students. On the other hand, broad social relations that are coupled with a high level of growth that's so high that it dissolves prestige turns the research multiversity into a solely mass HEI, and research multiversities don't go that far. Though every multiversity needs resources, the evolution of the multiversity is not governed primarily by economic scarcity. It's driven by the contrary logics of status intensification and status accumulation, quality and quantity. Institution by institution, the two drivers, selectivity and aggregation, combine in different ways. Some HEIs take both paths to status as far as they can take them. Others focus primarily on one of these. Others have no choice, perhaps, but to focus on the quantity, building quantity. All follow selective or aggregative logics variously in the different parts of their operation.